Hi, I'm Daniel Lucas.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101. Music 101 is great. It's empower music. Music itself, a legendary icon in the music industry. Another week, another whoopee, we're all gonna die. The legacy of the country Joe McDonald's fixing to die rock.
Yeah, absolutely. So popular music history often remembers the spectacle, the guitar hero, the legendary festival performance, the cultural explosion of a generation discovering its voice. Yet beneath those visible moments lies the quieter craft of songwriting. Songs endure not because they are loud or fashionable, but because they are constructed well enough to travel through time. In the turbulent cultural upheaval of the 1960s, one songwriter who understood that craft particularly well was Country Joe McDonald, the principal voice behind Country Joe and the Fish. Joe left us as well, so it is an appropriate time to consider how his songs fuse folk satire, psychedelic experimentation, and melodic discipline, creating a body of work that captured the voice of the Vietnam War era. In conclusion, today on Music 101, we explore the songwriting craft, cultural context, and enduring musical legacy of Country Joe McDonald.
Indeed, and Mr. Mick, when people talk about the San Francisco sound of the late 1960s, they usually begin with the Grateful Dead or Jefferson Airplane. But the Country Joe and the Fish seem to occupy this slightly different corner of the scene. Where did they come from musically?
They came from Berkeley, and that detail matters enormously. Berkeley in the mid-1960s was not simply a college town with coffee houses and guitars. It was arguably the most politically energized campus in the United States. The free speech movement with Mario Savio had erupted there in 1964, and student demonstrations against the Vietnam War were escalating almost weekly. When Country Joe McDonald began writing songs, he was immersed in that environment. Before he was widely known as a musician, he was involved in underground publishing. In fact, he helped produce a satirical political magazine called Rag Baby. The magazine printed early lyrics that would eventually evolve into his most famous composition. That background shaped his songwriting voice. McDonald was not simply trying to write rock songs, he was trying to write a commentary. When the band Country Joe and the Fish formed in 1965, they quickly became associated with the broader San Francisco psychedelic movement, yet they retained a distinctive identity because their lyrics were often direct and political rather than surreal or abstract. Their debut album, Electric Music for the Mind and Body, 1967, captured that blend of psychedelic sound and narrative songwriting. One of the album's most interesting tracks is Not So Sweet Martha Lorraine. What's fascinating about the song is the way it combines swirling organ textures with a story-driven lyrics. Psychedelic bands often prioritize atmosphere, but McDonald maintained a storyteller's instinct. In many ways, he stood halfway between the folk tradition and the emerging psychedelic rock movement. Folk artists like Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger had established the idea that songs could carry political messages. McDonald simply plugged that tradition into an electric amplifier. The result was a band whose music sounded experimental, but whose lyrical intent remained remarkably clear. In conclusion, Country Joe and the Fish emerged from Berkeley's political ferment, blending folk protest traditions with psychedelic rock to create a distinctive voice within the 1960s counterculture.
That brings us to the song everyone associated with the Country Joe. I feel like I'm fixing to die rag. Why does the song resonate so strongly, Mr. Mike?
Because it uses one of the oldest tricks in songwriting, contrast. The melody is cheerful, almost vaudevillian. It sounds like something from the ragtime era. If you heard the music alone, you might expect a lighthearted novelty song. But the lyrics are razor-sharp satire aimed at the Vietnam War. That contrast makes the message even stronger. Satirical songs often rely on that tension between cheerful music and critical lyrics. The listener experiences the humor first and the critique second. McDonald also understood something important about protest music, participation. The chorus is easy to sing. Audiences can join in almost immediately. Protest songs that invite participation travel much farther than songs that remain purely performative. This principle appears throughout American musical history. Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land became a cultural staple because people could sing it together. Bob Dylan's Blown in the Wind spread through the folk revival for the same reason. McDonald added something slightly different, biting humor. Instead of solemnly condemning war, he mocked it. And satire often exposes contradictions more effectively than anger alone. Although the song never dominated the Billboard charts, it spread rapidly through the anti-war movement in college campuses. By the late 1960s, it had become one of the most recognizable protest songs of the era. In conclusion, by pairing ragtime cheerfulness with biting satire, I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die Rag transformed anti-war commentary into one of the most memorable protest songs of the 1960s.
Mr. Meek, this song really took a legendary status after Woodstock, right?
McDonald's performance at Woodstock is one of the defining musical moments of the entire festival. Originally, the band was scheduled to perform together, but scheduling changes led to McDonald appearing solo with an acoustic guitar. Before he began to sing the song, he led the crowd in what has become known as the fish cheer. The chant worked almost like a warm-up ritual. It unified the crowd and prepared them to participate in the song, and that's exactly what happened. Hundreds of thousands of people joined the chorus. From a musical standpoint, the moment demonstrates the communal power of simple song structures. The melody is straightforward, the rhythm steady, and the chorus memorable. In many ways, the scene resembles older traditions of communal singing. Early Christian worship described in Acts often included call and response participation. The congregation itself became part of the music. Woodstock was obviously a secular gathering, but the emotional dynamics were similar. Music created a shared identity. Their identity was part protest, part celebration, and part generational self-definition. And McDonald's song captured it perfectly. The iconic fish cheer, which morphed into the more infamous four-letter variant at Woodstock, is often dismissed as mere countercultural insolence. But to understand the songwriter's war of country Joe McDonald, who passed away this March 7, 2026, we must look deeper. What Joe created was not just a protest. It was a secular liturgy designed to facilitate a mutual indwelling between a lone man with a guitar and a fragmented, traumatized audience. In the history of religions, liturgy serves as a navigation system for the soul, a structured repetition that moves the participant from isolation into communal identity. When Joe stepped onto that stage, he wasn't just performing. He was acting as a high priest of a resistance. He utilized the classic call and response mechanism, a structural hallmark of both the church and ancient Jewish psalmic traditions, to force the audience out of their default mode network of fear and into a state of collective action. From a neurological perspective, the cheer functions as a massive synchronized amygdala reset. By the time McDonald took the stage at Woodstock, the crowd was exhausted, rain-soaked, and hyper-vigilant. By demanding they yell at the top of their lungs, Joe triggered an intentional spike in respiratory output and vocal cord vibration, which stimulates the vagus nerve. The physiological shift moves the body from freeze to active response. He wasn't asking them to think, he was asking them to vibrate. True intimacy requires risk. The Fixin' to Die Rag is a masterclass in this. It uses gallows humor. Be the first one on your block to have your boy come home in a box, to confront the ultimate absence, death. The framework works because it has this dark, redemptive irony. McDonald, a Navy veteran, understood that you cannot defeat the military-industrial complex through dry policy. You defeat it by laughing at the pearly gates. This is what Mircea Eliade might call the eternal return. By spelling out the F word, the ultimate linguistic taboo of 1969, Joe was performing a ritual of desacralization. He took the power away from the masters of war and gave it to the broken and beloved in the mud. He transformed their collective trauma into a sacred scar, a mark of belonging that said, "We are all in this story together." Country Joe McDonald didn't just write a song. He built a cathedral of sound out of a borrowed guitar and a rope strap. He reminded us that in the face of a story that's killing you, the only life path is to sing your way through the darkness until the daylight comes. Woodstock is important in so many ways. And as we approach another anniversary of the event I've been writing about, Chip Monk, the famous announcer and lighting director extraordinaire from that groundbreaking event. In conclusion, the Woodstock performance transformed McDonald's satirical protest song into a massive communal experience that symbolized the spirit of the 1960s counterculture.
Very well said, Mr. Mike. Psychedelic rock sometimes gets criticized for prioritizing sonic entertainment or experimentation over songwriting. Did Country Joe avoid that problem?
For the most part, yes. McDonald believed that even experimental music should remain structured. Take Superbird. The release from Songs of Opposition, Rag Baby Talking Issue, Volume 1, is essentially a satirical critique of President Lyndon Johnson and the Vietnam War, yet musically it remains tight and focused. Another example is the instrumental Section 43. This track explores atmospheric textures, but it still follows a clear conversational arc. The melody gradually builds rather than dissolving into improvisation. That discipline reflects McDonald's understanding of songwriting fundamentals. A song should develop, not drift. Section 43 is at the center of a sublime, flawless album that's arguably the greatest psychedelic instrumental to come out of the San Francisco scene. Like 8 Miles High, but structurally looser, Section 43 becomes both a literal and metaphorical statement of chemically assisted boundless freedom, tinged with an edge of melancholy and regret. With its woozy, acid-drenched, fairground Farfisa organ, carving deep blue ripples in the tissues of your mind, and its multi-track raga rock guitars, Section 43 charts the peaks, the lows, and the dissolving ego into a collapsing universe of lysergic ecstasy. All luminous fog, shimmering space, time shifts, and possibilities. It carries the moment like nothing else, spaced-out wonder in the everlasting moment. Many psychedelic bands excelled at live improvisation, but struggled to create songs that endured beyond the moment. McDonald approached songwriting differently. Even when experimenting, he maintained structure, and structure is what allows music to travel across decades. In conclusion, by combining psychedelic experimentation with disciplined songwriting, McDonald ensured that his music retained lasting musical coherence.
Lasting indeed. You've mentioned songwriting craft several times. Was McDonald influenced by the pop tradition as well?
Yes, and that's an overlooked part of the story. Even though he was associated with the counterculture, McDonald wrote songs with a pop craftsman discipline. Consider Neil Sedaka's classic, Breaking Up is Hard to Do. Sedaka's work represented the Brill-building transition, songs carefully engineered for melodic impact. McDonald's songs, though politically charged, often followed similar structural principles, memorable hooks, concise verses, and strong choruses. This combination of protest themes and pop craftsmanship made his music more accessible than that of many other political artists. Listeners didn't need to agree with the message to enjoy the song. In conclusion, McDonald's songwriting fused countercultural themes with classic pop craftsmanship, creating protest music that remained melodically compelling.
Melodically compelling. Well, we love that, Mr. Mike. Many artists from the 1960s faded when the cultural moment passed. How did McDonald sustain his career?
He adapted. Over the decades, he recorded more than 30 albums and explored acoustic storytelling. One example is Save the Whales. The song reflects the environmental activism of the 1970s. This shift shows how McDonald broadened his themes beyond the Vietnam War. Longevity in music often requires reinvention. Artists like David Bowie and Neil Sedaka repeatedly reinvented themselves when the musical climate changed. McDonald did the same in a quieter way. In conclusion, McDonald's willingness to evolve musically allowed him to maintain a creative career long after the countercultural era ended.
Indeed. So are there later rock songwriters who carried forward the narrative style, Mr. Mike?
Country Joe's McDonald's narrative style, which combined the deadpan delivery of Woody Guthrie with a biting, satirical, and dark humor, created a blueprint for protest music that moved away from the earnestness of early 60s folk and into the more cynical, psychedelic grit of late 60s rock. While he viewed himself as a torchbearer of the Guthrie tradition, his influence on later rock songwriters is less about direct lineage of copycats and more about the legitimation of satirical protest. He showed that you could write about horrific subjects like the Vietnam War or environmental collapse, not just with sadness, but with a whoopee, we're all gonna die dark irony that made the absurdity of the political situation impossible to ignore. Later songwriters who carried this torch did so by adopting the detached narrator to critique power rather than just delivering a standard political sermon. Jello Biafra and the Dead Kennedys are perhaps the most direct vocal successor through their style, though their style differs significantly. When Biafra wrote Holiday in Cambodia or California Uber Alles, he utilized the same Country Joe style deadpan delivery to lampoon the American political class. The satire is so thick it feels like a dark joke, forcing the listener to confront the horror beneath the irony. Frank Zappa shared McDonald's disdain for the hippie drug movement and the establishment alike. Zappa's narrative style, using characters and absurd scenarios to comment on societal rot, mirrors the way McDonald used the ragtime rhythm of his protest music to create cognitive dissonance. Neil Young, while often more earnest, Young's protest work, for example, Ohio, or his later political albums like Living with War, shares McDonald's commitment to addressing specific geopolitical events. Young also shares McDonald's long-term commitment to veterans' causes, proving that the protest isn't just a phase of the 60s, but a lifelong stewardship. The Clash, though they were punk, Joe Strummer and Mick Jones utilized the same talking blues and agitprop narrative structure as in Clampdown, found in McDonald's work. They understood, as Joe did, that the protest must be catchy to be heard. It's important to note, as Country Joe himself did in interviews, that he did not see music as a change agent in a policy sense. He saw it as a morale booster and a way to validate feelings. This is the key to his narrative legacy. Later songwriters didn't necessarily try to change the law through their lyrics, but they did continue the practice of creating a shared emotional reality. When the political machine feels like it is moving toward catastrophe, the narrative style of the absurd, the style McDonald mastered, is the only language that accurately reflects how people feel on the ground. An interview with Mark Hummel provides an excellent look into Country Joe's own reflections on his songwriting process and the role of protest music as a vehicle for social and individual validation. In short, while you might not hear a direct Fixing to Die sound-alike on the charts today, you hear the DNA of his satire in any artist who uses dark humor to speak truth to power. He taught a generation that you can be anti-war and still be funny, and that being funny about death is often the only way to stay sane in his war zone. As an artist, Country Joe demonstrated that rock songs work best when they combine narrative detail with memorable hooks. In conclusion, McDonald demonstrated that strong storytelling and melody remain the foundation of enduring rock songwriting.
So, Mr. Mink, when we step back and look at the whole picture, what is McDonald's lasting contribution to music history?
His legacy lies in demonstrating that political songs can also be great songs. Many protest songs disappear once the political moment fades. McDonald's best work survives because the songwriting holds up. Take rock and roll and rock and soul music. Released in 1967, the song became one of the band's few charting hits, reaching number 35 on the Billboard Hot 100. The track celebrates the transformative power of music itself, its ability to energize communities and reshape cultural attitudes. And that's perhaps the ultimate lesson of McDonald's career. Songs are stories set to melody. They carry ideas farther than arguments because people remember them. The Vietnam War ended decades ago. The protests have faded into history, but the songs remain. In conclusion, Country Joe McDonald's music endures because it united satire, melody, and storytelling into songs that captured the voice of a generation while remaining musically compelling for future listeners.
Well said, well said, Mr. Mike. One thing that strikes me is the country Joe did not invent protest music. There's a long tradition behind it. Where does he fit in that lineage?
The most reliable way to trace the lineage is to refer to the protest song Lineage of Bob Dylan and Phil Oakes, songwriting craft, the San Francisco scene, and McDonald's later career. Protest music in America didn't begin in the 1960s. In fact, it reaches back into the labor songs and folk ballads of the early 20th century. One of the central figures in that tradition was Woody Guthrie, whose songs blended storytelling with social critique. Guthrie's famous composition, This Land Is Your Land, was written in 1940 as a response to inequality during the Great Depression. The song's power comes from its simplicity. It sounds like a patriotic anthem, but the deeper verses question economic injustice and exclusion. Guthrie understood that a song should carry both pride and critique simultaneously. That idea profoundly influenced the next generation of songwriters. By the early 1960s, Bob Dylan had taken Guthrie's model and adapted it to the emerging folk revival. Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind became one of the defining songs of the civil rights movement. The song asks a series of rhetorical questions rather than delivering explicit answers. That poetic ambiguity allowed listeners to project their own moral concerns into the song. Country Joe McDonald's writing sits further down this lineage. He inherited Guthrie's populist tone and Dylan's sense that songs could articulate the moral tensions of the era. But he added something else, satire. Instead of asking questions or telling symbolic stories, McDonald often confronted political absurdity directly. That difference makes his songs feel sharper and more comedic. Where Dylan sometimes sounds prophetic, McDonald often sounds mischievous. Yet both approaches aim at the same goal, forcing listeners to think. And this reflects an ancient tradition. The Hebrew prophets, figures like Isaiah and Jeremiah, often used poetic language to criticize the moral failures of their societies. In Isaiah, the prophet laments the corruption of a nation that had lost its moral bearings. Protest songwriting in America echoes that prophetic voice, even when the writers themselves operate in secular context. Country Joe McDonald was participating in that tradition. In conclusion, McDonald's music belongs to a long lineage of protest songwriting, stretching from Woody Guthrie to Bob Dylan, combining social critique with memorable melodies that challenge listeners to confront the moral dilemmas of their time.
Mr. Mick, another less well-known name that comes in discussions of protest music is the one you mentioned, Phil Oakes. How does compare to Country Joe?
That's a fascinating comparison. Phil Oakes and Country Joe McDonald were contemporaries, but their styles were quite different. Oakes was perhaps the most explicitly political songwriter of the folk era. His songs read almost as newspaper editorials set to music. Take his famous composition, I Ain't Marchin' Anymore. The song traces American military history from the Revolutionary War to Vietnam, concluding with a declaration that the singer refuses to continue fighting. What's remarkable is how Oakes used historical narrative to build his argument. Each verse moves through time, accumulating weight until the final refrain feels inevitable. McDonald's approach is less historical and more satirical. While Oakes constructs logical arguments, McDonald often exposes absurdity. But the two artists share something important, clarity. Neither writer hides behind vague symbolism. Their songs address specific political realities. This clarity is what allowed their music to resonate with audiences during the Vietnam era. And yet their careers unfolded differently. Oakes remained closely tied to the folk movement, while McDonald moved into psychedelic rock and the broader San Francisco scene. The difference illustrates how flexible protest music can be. It can exist within acoustic folk traditions or within electrified rock environments. What matters most is the songwriter's ability to translate political tension into memorable musical form. In conclusion, while Phil Oakes delivered political critique through historical narrative and folk tradition, Country Joe McDonald used satire and psychedelic rock to reach similar audiences with a different artistic strategy.
We talk about Berkeley and the political environment, but what about the broader San Francisco music scene, Mr. Mike?
The scene was extraordinary. In the mid-1960s, San Francisco became one of the most creative musical ecosystems in the world. Bands like Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, and Big Brother and The Holding Company were experimenting with extended improvisation, psychedelic soundscapes, and new forms of stage performance. Country Joe and the Fish belonged to that community, but they retained their political identity. A good example of the band's psychedelic side is Grace. The song demonstrates the band's ability to combine melodic structure with swirling instrumental textures. San Francisco's concert venues, especially the Fillmore Auditorium and the Avalon Ballroom, encouraged experimentation. Promoters like Bill Graham organized concerts that felt more like communal experiences than traditional performances. Light shows, improvisation, and long musical sets were common. That environment allowed musicians to stretch the boundaries of what rock music could become. Yet among all that experimentation, the most memorable songs remain the ones with strong melodies and clear lyrical themes. Country Joe McDonald understood that principle. Even when performing with psychedelic instrumentation, he continued writing songs that audiences could remember. In conclusion, the San Francisco music scene encouraged radical experimentation, but McDonald's commitment to melody and lyrical clarity ensured that his songs remain accessible within that creative explosion.
Let's talk more about songwriting itself, Mr. Mack. What made McDonald effective as a songwriter?
Three elements: melody, satire, and narrative. First, melody. Even when his lyrics were politically charged, McDonald wrote melodies that listeners could easily remember. That's crucial because a protest song cannot spread unless people can sing it. Second, satire. Satire allows the songwriter to expose contradictions without sounding preachy. Humor disarms resistance. Third, narrative. Many of McDonald's songs tell stories or depict recognizable situations. That storytelling instinct connects him to the folk tradition. McDonald wrote with narrative clarity. The lyrics describe a generation trying to define itself in an uncertain cultural terrain. That theme echoes the generational identity struggles expressed in 1960s protest music. Songwriters often draw from similar emotional landscapes, even when their musical styles differ. In conclusion, McDonald's songwriting strength came from combining memorable melodies with satire narrative, a craft tradition shared by many of rock's most enduring writers.
So, Mr. Mick, what happened to McDonald after the 1960s? Did his music change as a political climate shifted?
Yes, it did. Like many artists of his generation, McDonald generally moved away from the intense political atmosphere of the Vietnam era. He began exploring acoustic music, historical themes, and personal storytelling. One example is Kiss My, You Can Guess What. The song shows his continued commitment to humor and satire. Another interesting development was an interest in historical American musical traditions. McDonald recorded albums dedicated to Civil War songs and other historical material. That move may seem surprising at first, but it actually fits the pattern of many folk-influenced artists. As musicians age, they often return to the roots of the traditions that shaped them. Bob Dylan did something similar with his exploration of traditional American standards on albums like Shadows in the Night. McDonald's later work reflects a musician who continued to explore American musical history rather than remaining frozen in the cultural moment of the 1960s. In conclusion, McDonald's later career demonstrated an artist continually evolving, exploring humor, history, and acoustic traditions beyond the protest music of his youth.
Mr. Mick, as we wrap up, when listeners encounter these songs today, decade after the Vietnam War, what should they listen for?
They should listen to the craft. Political contexts change, cultural debates evolve, but well-written songs remain compelling because they operate on multiple levels. At one level, I feel like I'm fixing the die rag as a satirical commentary on a specific war. At another level, it's simply a brilliantly constructed piece of songwriting, memorable melody, sharp lyrics, and participatory structure. That combination ensures that the song survives beyond its historical moment. There's a lesson there for every songwriter. Music history is full of artists who captured a moment but failed to build songs that could travel beyond it. McDonald succeeded because he understood both the message and the medium. And that balance between conviction and craft is what keeps listeners returning to the music decades later. In conclusion, Country Joe McDonald's songs endure not merely because of their political context, but because they embody the timeless principles of strong songwriting.
Very well said, Mr. Meg. Very well said indeed. The legacy of Country Joe McDonald's. I feel like I'm fixed into thy rag. This episode explores one of the most iconic protest songs of the 1960s, a satirical anthem that captured the growing frustration, skepticism, and resistance surrounding the Vietnam War era. So, Mr. Mick, would you like to plug in something?
I appreciate the opportunity. Write the book, Grow the Business. Connect with me on LinkedIn. G. Mick, the Doctor of Digital Smith, PhD. Listen to the Doctor of Digital podcast and also pick up a couple of volumes I have on Amazon, Burning America, and also On Track, Ian Hunter. And if you love music, support true fans.
Yes, indeed. Let's support Mr. Mick, the Doctor of Digital, and please do follow our official website, WW Universal Podcast Network, because you can see there all the podcasts that we are creating, and four of them are co-hosts with Mr. Mick at Music 101, Sex 101, Love Letters, as well as Mental Health 101. So please do visit www.universalpodcast.net. So, Mr. Mick, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, my friend. Till next time, Deus Vol.
Welcome, people. See you soon. Okay.